Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future, live or on demand. I'll bring you some of the stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a mass vehicle recall hit South Africa with thousands of cars pulled over concerning safety defects. A new report reveals 12 million South Africans are drowning in debt. The fuel levy hike squeezing food services as kitchens hunt for cost relief. And financial firms facing rising heat as regulators tighten their grip in 2025. It's Tuesday, the 27th of May. Now, you might have read that South Africa is currently experiencing a significant wave of vehicle recalls with over 1,000 cars from major brands like Jeep, Mercedes-Benz, Audi, Volkswagen and Volvo being pulled from the roads due to serious safety defects. This involves airbags, brakes, batteries and seatbelts. And these issues are linked to the notorious Takata airbag scandal. It's raised urgent questions about the timeliness of manufacturer responses and the effectiveness of consumer protection mechanisms. So I want to delve a little further into these concerns, and I'm in conversation now with Prudence Moyelwa, who's head of complaints and investigations at the National Consumer Commission. It's the body responsible for overseeing product safety and recalls in South Africa. Prudence, a very warm welcome to you. And if I read or understand this correctly, many of these recalls pertain to vehicles sold between 2014 and 2016. Why are these defects only being addressed now, nearly a decade later?
We have come to understand as the National Consumer Commission that some of the safety concerns develop over time. So it wouldn't be a manufacturing defect that would present itself immediately after the vehicle has been manufactured. So what would happen is that defects would then be reported to the supplier over time, and then they would be able to then investigate. For example, when we met with Honda yesterday, they were explaining with regard to how as an international brand, they would pick up that there is a problem with, let's say, a fuel pump picked up in Namibia. Mm. And then they would also pick up that in South Africa and in other parts of the world. They would then pick up similar kind of defect over time, and then they would look into them. They would obviously fix those ones, but then as they come up over time, they would then realize that there is a problem, that they might need to do a wider recall on the products that have been saved, that have been identified. So it's something that we as the National Consumer Commission are observing, that though, in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, we have to be told if there is a manufacturing defect. But we've now come to realize that some of these things develop over time. It's not necessarily just the issue of wear and tear, but some of the defects that should not be happening are discovered, when the cars are already on the road.
I understand that, but is the Commission nonetheless satisfied with the speed of action from the auto manufacturers once an issue has been identified, or could they move quicker?
I think one of the things that we're discussing with them, because I think I need to also tell your listeners that we are now engaging directly with each and every supplier that has, broadly on their processes in terms of development, research and development around the manufacturing of their vehicles, and also around the manner of communication, especially for international brands. As you know, most of the vehicles are imported into South Africa, just the level of communication. What they tell us is immediately once they hear from, the head office or wherever the case may be, they then start a recall immediately. So they would do the investigations in the background. But we did also say that what is concerning to the National Consumer Commission sometimes is how long it has taken. If you can look over the years, you know, some of the investigations that have arisen out of product recall was actually with where we identified that there might have been negligence or where information is hidden from us. So as the National Consumer Commission, we are fully empowered by the Consumer Protection Act to start an investigation that can result in punitive action being taken against suppliers who do not communicate in time or who cannot demonstrate that the actions that they have taken were in the consumer interest.
And are you going to use the teeth then that you have to ensure that manufacturers identify and report defects more promptly?
We have and we continue to do so. So this engagement that I also lead are meant to identify, just in terms of the time lapse, the communication, and as to whether even with international brands, they've taken steps to ensure that they get to the bottom of the safety issues as soon as possible. And even in the research and development in manufacturing, they've taken all the necessary steps to ensure that the cars they put on the road are safe.
What are the punitive or legal consequences for manufacturers right now who fail to initiate any kind of recall in a timely manner or adequately address known defects?
I mean, case in point, you know, if you recall what happened with the Ford case, it also arose out of a product recall. Because what we found as the commission in terms of prohibited conduct was that they did not perhaps act in a manner that protect consumer rights in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. Hence that punitive, you know, penalty that we agreed upon. I think it was around 35, 45 million rand. And also the Act empowers us to take matters to the tribunal, wherein if we are able to demonstrate that indeed they put consumers' lives at risk, to even impose a penalty of up to 10% of the annual turnover.
I just want to ask you one final question. I did reference this at the start of our conversation, and that's the Takata airbag issue. It's been a global concern for years now. How is the Commission engaging with manufacturers in that respect to address the problem for the local market?
Yes, thank you for that question. I think the Takata airbag, we realized obviously after Takata went under liquidation, and what we are also starting to find out from the manufacturers that we're engaging with is that they have had to implement other ways of replacing the Takata airbag. So what we found with the problems with the Takata airbags is that over time, those airbags are presenting with problems. As you correctly stated with the, I think the Jeep and the Citroen recalls, and I think also this morning, we got a further recall notifications from Stellantis as well with regard to other brands, is that they do not deploy in the way that they're supposed to, which is also a safety concern. And I think part of our engagements with all the suppliers where the recalls are, we specifically ask them to, you know, talk to the commission about how they're dealing with the replacement of the airbags, because it concerns the majority of the cars on the road.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Prudence Moyilwa, who is Head of Complaints and Investigations at the National Consumer Commission.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power. You just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Despite near universal access to formal financial services in this country, millions of citizens are still caught in a worsening cycle of debt, poverty, and financial stress. I don't really need to tell you that. Now, the 2024 FinScope Consumer Survey reveals that around 12 million adults are over-indebted, many relying on credit just to afford basics like food. Financial inclusion may be high, but genuine financial well-being certainly is not. I want to discuss this in a little more detail with Jabulani Khumalo from Finmark Trust to discuss the latest findings and maybe offer some insight into the steps that we need to shift from mere access to real resilience. Jabulani, a very warm welcome. The data shows 98% of adults have access to formal financial services. Millions, as I've just said, are in debt. How do you explain this disconnect?
Thank you so much. And maybe let us first touch on the research methodology and the credibility. The sample was designed to be representative at the national, provincial, and both urban and rural areas. We conducted a total of 5,600 interviews, which took place in respondents' homes between August and October 2024. And to accurately reflect the country's demographic makeup, the collected data was weighted using 2024 mid-year population. Now, going back to your question, yes, this year FinScope reveals a stark contrast. While 98% of adults have access to formal financial services, the reality on the ground tells a different story. Despite high inclusion, millions are grappling with over-indebtedness, with estimated, as we have said, 12 million adults struggling under mounting debt, often relying on credit to buy essentials like food. The survey shows that many are facing stagnant or worsening financial conditions, highlighting a crucial gap between access and true financial resilience. It underscores that having a bank account or access to credit isn't enough. What really matters is whether people are financially healthy and able to weather economic storms.
12 million adults in this country are now considered over indebted. That is an eye-watering number. What, in your opinion, are the long-term implications for household resilience and the economy if this continues?
Well, there's a very negative impact to this. As we have said, the improved financial inclusion means more people now have access. And however, the study reveals that many mainly use these services to receive funds, such as social grants and support. And the stats will even show you that around 60% have some insurance. And however, it largely focuses on high federal cost, leaving many vulnerable to risk like floods and other hazards. Therefore, while more people are connected, it doesn't necessarily mean they are more financially empowered or resilient. Access alone is just the first step. The real goal is enable people to use these tools to improve their financial well-being.
The proportion, says the survey, of financially healthy individuals dropping from 24% to 16% in 12 months. Do you have a useful definition for me of what financially healthy is?
Now, when we assess this this indicator, we put around four dimensions, including whether people are able to be resilient when the shocks comes, and also are people coping with their income versus their expenses, and but also when they're borrowing money or when they're saving money, are they looking at the economic opportunities or what? And then at the end, we look at how do they react to these situations. So looking at these dimensions, we saw people really struggling in terms of coping with the resilience. The score is very low, but also many households are struggling with maintaining the incomes to last them throughout the month. So all of these dimensions giving us the low score. We then saw a drop from 24% of people who are financially healthy going down to only 16%.
The informal sector, if I've read the survey correctly, employs nearly half of the working population. That does make sense, but remains undervalued. Fair point. Are there policy changes, do you think, that could unlock its full potential? And adding to that, I'm also wondering what kind of role the financial services industry needs to play in designing better products that meet the needs of that demographic.
Well, the picture that we're getting from the data, correctly as I've said, it says 46% of the workforce is coming from this sector and saving a lifeline for many, especially youth and low-income households. It provides flexible short-term jobs in domestic and personal services, construction and manual labor. One will note also that it is often the only income sources available for these vulnerable groups. However, many informal workers earn below the minimum wage, which makes income differences more noticeable. Supporting then this sector can create more stable employment, reducing youth unemployment and helping to bridge the income gap. So we really think that strengthening informal businesses is key to building broader economic resilience and ensuring vulnerable groups can thrive. And then we think maybe moving forward, the policymakers really need to come up with the targeted policies to address systematic barriers. And as we have said, it will then speak more on the high unemployment rate, the income inequality, and the access, and just broader access of financial inclusion. That speaks to this vulnerable sector.
And the second part of my question, the financial services industry designing better products that meet the needs of this cohort, are they doing a good enough job, do you think?
Well, when you look deep into the data, you will doubt that, because the number of or the stats of people who are able to use the financial formal financial mechanisms to cope with resilience, but also to invest in the development of their businesses, is sitting around 24-23%, and it only targets those who are formal employed. And the survey does show us that the formal employed, it's only 21%. So the 8.2 million in this sector, they remain vulnerable. The only insurance product that they are able to use is the funeral cover. The sector is not doing enough.
Well, that is a very useful but very disturbing snapshot of consumer life in South Africa right now, the 2024 FinScope Consumer Survey. I've been in conversation with Jabulani Khumalo from the Finmark Trust. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The fuel levy hike announced in Budget 3.0, you'll remember 16 cents more per litre of petrol and 15 cents for diesel, may not sound like a lot in isolation. But for South Africa's food service sector, it really is a blow that's going to hit deep into the supply chain. With every delivery truck, fryer and refrigerated van now costing more to run, already tight margins are under siege. So the big question is, how do businesses keep prices in check without serving thinner portions or cutting quality? It's a challenge that is being felt across the industry, including by Southern Oil. It's a major player in palm, sesame and nut oil, services about 1,600 customers and exports to 10 countries worldwide. I'm joined now by Morne Boertus, Commercial Director at Southern Oil. So Morne, a very warm welcome, and maybe just let's start with this. How much of an immediate impact will this levy hike have on the average food service operator's cost base?
I think it's important to, like you mentioned, to understand it's the full supply chain. So if you're looking at something like edible oil, then the big impact is already felt on farm level. Farmers being a very high consumer of diesel. So the cost impact starts there, and then it flows into the manufacturing side and then to transport to delivery, and then in the end it gets to the restaurant that goes to the consumer. So it's a cumulative aspect that we're looking at, and not just the 15 or 16 cents. So in that aspect, it's not necessarily felt immediately, but it builds onto the cost structure.
And where do you think the pressure is ultimately going to be felt most sharply?
It all ends always at the consumer. So I think the mitigation actions is critical for the manufacturers, and looking at the whole chain, which has margin creep in the end. But in the end, there will be some pressure felt at the consumer. And that then just have a knock-on effect, because then there is less expendable income, and then it flows back into the economy.
So let's talk about mitigation in just a moment, but I'm sure you'd agree with me, Morne, that many restaurants and caterers are already struggling post-pandemic. And I guess the question is, how much room do they have to absorb these kind of cost shocks? And I'm going to guess not very much.
Yes, I agree with the statement that restaurant chains is under enormous pressure. The groups are affected, but I think the major impact sits on the mom and pop stores, the smaller restaurants that's trying, owner managed, trying to just survive day to day.
So let's talk about mitigation then. Are there smart operational changes that businesses can make quickly to reduce waste and cut energy or fuel costs, in your opinion?
So if I bring it back to our industry, so we produce canola oil and other oils. But if you look at that aspect, what we have seen is that the following a circular economy is critical. So not just buying oil from a supplier, but buying oil and selling your used oil. So you're recovering some cost on that aspect, and it limits the transportation aspect. Secondly, to be educated and understanding the product you work with, because not all oils are the same. And sometimes the statement of penny wise, pound foolish does actually impact it, because if you have the right quality product, you can use it longer. If you can use it longer, then your end cost to serve actually does come down.
Morne, that's one solution. I guess it's inevitable as well that businesses will start to shorten their supply chains or even go local to maybe reduce transport costs. Maybe that sounds good in theory, but I wonder if it's easier said than done.
It's very difficult, because if you're looking at South Africa, just as an example, your only 100% local supplier of edible oil is canola. All other oils, although we have very good soya and sunflower crops, we still don't produce sufficient amount of stock, so it's imported. So that's just one aspect to it, and that in the end, unfortunately, hurts our pockets.
You spoke about the canola solution, but what about more broadly in terms of menu engineering in this environment? Can one actually do that to help protect margins?
Yes, and you probably will have to. You'll have to look at portion sizes. The important part, I think, is being transparent, because if you go look at restaurants and restaurant groups, they generally only change their menus twice a season. And that will mean when they review the menus come August, September, they would need to take into consideration where the cost factors are and either review the offering or the portion size.
That is all well and good, Morne, but I understand that consumers need to be price sensitive, but they're also quality conscious. So a business has got to be careful in walking that tightrope without alienating their customer base, surely.
Yes, you're 100% correct. Quality is critical, and it is critical to understand where you're getting your product from. Because in the market, a lot of lower quality products find its way, especially when people are cash strapped. And then it not only affects the quality of the end product they are supplying, but it also affects the health benefits and health qualities of the product that's being offered to the consumers.
Thank you very much for talking to me today. That's Morne Boetes, Commercial Director at Southern Oil.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you that South Africa's financial sector is under mounting regulatory pressure, from toughened anti-money laundering enforcement and crypto licensing requirements to looming accountability for executives and scrutiny of greenwashing. Compliance is no longer a back office box ticking exercise. It has now become front and center, a boardroom priority. And I want to explore that in a little more detail now with Anel de Meyer, who's a partner at Weber Wenzel and co-author of a detailed piece on the regulatory heat facing financial institutions this year. Anel, a very warm welcome. And I want to pick up on that phrase, regulatory heat, which you've described this year as. Where is the pressure most intense right now for financial institutions?
Well, Jeremy, you would have seen we picked up on five trends, but I think the two that are most important or that we're seeing across the board is accountability shifting from institutional accountability to individual accountability. So executives and C-suite executives that are, you know, being picked by the regulator for issues with compliance, etc., and facing more personal scrutiny for their role that they play in ensuring the compliance health of their financial institution. And the other is also post South Africa's grey listing, we are seeing that the regulator is just picking up on making sure that the anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing compliance issues for our financial institutions is very, very tight, and there's no tick box compliance exercise anymore that is considered to be good enough. They're doing a real deep dive. And in cryptocurrency, since the FSCA has designated a cryptocurrency a financial product, they now have to, cryptocurrency providers now has to be licensed and also has to comply with anti-money laundering protections, consumer protections, and they also have to have their own RMCP. So we're seeing across those three aspects a huge change, but you know, all of them in different sectors and ways, depending on where the global pressure is coming from.
Let me pick you up on the first point, which was executive accountability. As you say, a major theme. We obviously are seeing a real shift from corporate liability to personal liability, all well and good. But is there enough awareness, do you think, of what the implications are?
I think that we are seeing, at least with financial institutions, that they are picking up on that. And they have, you know, come for advice on sort of how to deal with that. I think it's always a pressure point on, you know, you're running a very large organization and, you know, there's different levels of oversight for different portfolios. And so we've sort of picked up with clients that, you know, some of the main things that they can do to look at that is to know that this is something that is coming. It is changing. And it's not just coming from our South African regulators. It's across the board in the UK and Australia, and our regulators are following suit. They want to make sure that they're aligned with global best practice, and they want leadership to set the tone. So I think it's good for financial institutions to know that this is a focus area, and a way to combat that and to make sure that, you know, your financial institution is on par with that. One is executives must know that what they are accountable for. There should be a clear delineation in role mapping and knowing what you're responsible for. But they must also know that, you know, it's unfair to penalize an executive for failures in an area where they had no visibility or authority. So, you know, the regulators must also ensure accountability is tied to real control. So there must be a distinction between misconduct and oversight failure. But the fact of the matter is the regulator is doing more inspections at board level and wanting to know who knowed what when. So, you know, executives must delineate their roles and responsibilities and then take control, because the regulator is no longer okay with, well, it wasn't my area. It's not my area of compliance. They want to see leadership knowing what's going on in the organization.
Let me pick you up on grey listing, and I wonder how coordinated local regulators are in enforcing anti-money laundering rules. Is that sufficient, do you think, or could more be done?
I think we've seen a very big drive, but there's definitely a big coordination between the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the Prudential Authority, African Reserve Bank. They're definitely all talking to one another, coordinating with one another. And we've seen some of the regulators dish out different penalties to the same institution on sort of the same misconduct, but under different legislation. So I think the regulator has definitely shown, you know, a coordinated approach, and that it's something that they're very serious about, and they're doing a lot about it. And the fines have increased also significantly from previous years. And in fact, it's actually something that financial institutions, you know, have struggled with, because it's not always clear how the significant penalties is tied to the misconduct. But it definitely shows that the regulators are very, very serious, and they are doing everything in their power to ensure that, you know, South Africa is at a global standard on this, and that we do get off the grey list.
So just some advice in conclusion then. How can firms turn compliance into a strategic advantage rather than a burden, which I imagine many of them would see it as?
So one of the things is definitely just to be proactive. I think some of the things that we've experienced is that, you know, financial institutions have a particular thought about a piece of legislation, or, you know, they're just not up to speed with the latest, you know, aspect of what needs to be complied with, and then they're sort of caught unawares when the regulator knocks on their door. So I think your compliance department and, you know, the people that are dealing with specific compliance issues just need to be proactive and aware of the new legislative pieces, and then working with, you know, the financial institution, working with the regulator, they're always very open to you, you know, contacting them and debating things with them, maybe reaching out to your legal advisor, but just have a, you know, solidified plan on your RMCP must actually be on point. You have to comply with X, Y, and Z regulation, and then have a team that does that and does that properly. So I think it just needs to be something that's not in the background, because then it becomes a burden when you realize that's not something you're actively working on. It's something you sort of do as a tick box. It every day, and you're aware of where the legislator's focus is at, then I think it becomes a bit easier to deal with it on a day-to-day.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Anel de Meyer from Weber Wenzel. I appreciate your time. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.